He's a Marine veteran, but not a U.S. citizen. Now, Roman Sabal is stuck at the border with Mexico.
The border people said that we could not get in because it was ICE who was supposed to authorize us to get into the country.
Also, Brazil introduces military education into some public schools. The goal? To fight crime in the community.
These schools are in areas that are very violent.
Plus, the Red Cross warns that heat is the new disaster we should prep for.
We don't see it. It doesn't have the startling image of places being flooded. But that's one of the tricky things about heat, is the silent aspect of it.
I'm Marco Werman. Those stories and a feminist take on tango.
The tango is macho. Was macho. Not anymore.
All that and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Who belongs in this country and who doesn't? That conversation has consumed the U.S. lately. It's been difficult and often ugly, especially for people caught up in the immigration debate. Roman Sabal is one of them. Originally from Belize, Sabal wanted to be a U.S. citizen. In the late 1980s, he came here on a tourist visa and then used a fake ID to join the military. He served in the Marine Corps for 6 years, and his officers told him citizenship would be an option. Sabal was going through the naturalization process 10 years ago when he visited Belize for health care. Ever since, U.S. officials have not let him return to finish his paperwork. On Monday, he was at the San Diego border crossing, feeling optimistic about the citizenship interview he had scheduled for later that day.
I was confident that all the paperwork was ready, you know, being that I was told that everything was ready, just come and, going to go across, do my interview, and hopefully same day got sworn in. And so I was really looking forward to it. I had explained to my kids that, you know, that this was the process. And they were all excited. They are looking out for me, waiting for me, but they were turned away. The border people said that we could not get in because it was ICE who was supposed to authorize us to get into the country and not the people at the border.
So that was the only explanation they gave you?
Yes, sir. That was all and nothing else after that.
So, Roman, you lived in the U.S. for more than a decade. You joined the Marines in 1987, eager to serve the U.S., and you returned to Belize for a visit in 2008, and a judge ordered you to be deported at a court hearing you did not know about because you weren't in the U.S. What made you think, though, when you left the States, that it would be easy to return?
Back then, I was assured that becoming a citizen would not be any problem. I used to be back and forth, you know, visiting my mom in Belize and coming back with no problem.
So your career in the Marines is pretty impressive. You traveled to South Korea, Japan, Thailand, and the Philippines. Do you think having served in the U.S. military for 6 years means you should automatically deserve citizenship?
Well, no, that's not what I'm saying. When I put my life on the line for the country and I have no criminal record, I'm just disappointed, but I'm still hopeful.
Roman, what's been the hardest part of this whole episode for you?
My children. You know, I've missed all these birthdays, you know, all these Christmases, Thanksgivings, all, you know, holding my children's hands, you know, and but it's difficult, but life goes on, and like I said, hopefully something positive is going to come out through all this.
Roman, thank you very much for your time, for your thoughts, and we're wishing you good luck.
Thank you very much, and you're very, very welcome.
Victoria Starrett is Roman Sabal's attorney.
The immigration system is clearly broken, and it's particularly broken for individuals who have served honorably in the U.S. in uniform. Congress has created a special and free path for these veterans to become citizens, yet there's not a clear process for them to access this opportunity despite demonstrating their statutory eligibility. U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services has had interviews at the border and consulates for other veterans with deportation orders, yet they're unwilling to provide these opportunities until veterans spend unnecessary financial and physical energy pursuing paths we all know will ultimately be denied. Roman has been forced to be separated from his two children, including his 13-year-old daughter and his 20-year-old son. He's been forced to miss his son's high school graduation. I think it's been hardest on his daughter. I think it's hard for her to understand why someone like her father, who served honorably in the military, who has never been convicted of any crime, who has been a good father, who has tried, you know, to be in his children's lives through Skype, and phone calls and, you know, doing whatever he can to support them despite being forcibly separated from them. You know, it's hard for her to understand why they can't be reunited.
That's Victoria Starrett, an attorney for veteran Roman Sabol, a 6-year veteran of the U.S. Marine Corps. Starrett was with him on Monday at the Tijuana-San Diego border when he was on his way to a scheduled citizenship interview and U.S. officials turned him away. We reached out to ICE for comment on Roman Sabol's case. We did not hear back by airtime. The story of Nazanin Zaghari-Ratcliffe continues to worry diplomats and her friends. She's the British-Iranian woman we've told you about who was arrested in Tehran in 2016. Iran accuses her of spying. She and her family say that's ludicrous. At the time, the British Foreign Secretary Boris Johnson made inaccurate comments that were used as evidence against her. For 3 years now, her British husband has campaigned for her release. And this week, Richard Ratcliffe got some news. He had just enough time in a taxi today to update us.
She's been transferred from Evin prison in Tehran, which is where she's been held for the past 3 years, to a mental ward of a public hospital in Tehran. We know that happened because she called to say it was going to happen, and then her father went down to the hospital and got confirmation that she was being held there. But we've not been able to have any access to her. So yesterday, her dad went to try and get access. Today, her mum went to try and get access, and they've been denied. All we know is that she's now held under the control of the Revolutionary Guard, who are the people that originally arrested her. They're different from the normal prison guards.
Mm. You had been pushing for your wife to be moved to a hospital while she was on her hunger strike. Are you happy that that condition has been met?
That's exactly right. We were pushing for her to get medical treatment, and on the face of it, it looks like medical treatment might be being provided. So on Monday, we were very pleased that it's finally happening. And generally, it's a good sign when anything positive happens, could be a step towards, you know, a release. At the same time, the fact that they won't say what treatment she's actually being given and they won't let any of the family go and visit is a much more ominous sign. Because the other thing that happened when she was on hunger strike, she kept being taken by the Revolutionary Guard for interrogation and then threatening that she would need to cooperate with them, she would need to give them something back, she would need to sign some denouncement about the UK government, she would need to sign some sort of confession. And of course, if you're stuck in a psychiatric ward and isolated, goodness knows what's actually happening.
I mean, Iran's Revolutionary Guard is almost always involved in these high-stakes situations. Do you still suspect that Nazanin might be forced into signing a confession, and why?
Well, I was really surprised that was something that she was being pressured to do, because in some ways we're such a high-profile case that you would have thought that was the last thing that would make any sense. But that was explicitly their demand. I'm not sure whether they actually mean the confession for the purposes of persuading anyone, but certainly as a tool of pressure on the person being held, I think it's often used as a tactic.
You've spent a lot of time outside the Iranian embassy in London. You've pushed for the British government to get more involved in your wife's case. What has that been like, trying to stay hopeful for a release, even though you've had disappointments in the past?
3 years we've been campaigning, and there have been plenty of false storms in that time, and it's quite hard to keep energy going. The specifics of being on hunger strike in front of the Iranian embassy was physically quite tough, but emotionally quite an overwhelming experience. We had all sorts of people come down to show solidarity. Lots of British parliamentarians came, but also lots of ordinary British people and British Iranians came down to sort of say, listen, your story is also our story, and please keep going. In terms of keeping hopeful, I think our situation was completely arbitrary when it started, and it will be arbitrary one day when it ends. There was an American green card holder that was released about a month ago. One wouldn't have expected that, given the sort of tensions between the US and Iran, but it happened. So it's important to keep an eye out for the maybe, because one day it will happen.
Given how Boris Johnson really threw a spanner in the works when he expressed his thoughts on your wife's detention, and he's seemingly about to become the new prime minister, any thoughts on him today?
That's right. He obviously is associated with Nazanin's case, was used to justify a second court case against her, and recently wouldn't take responsibility for the negative consequences of his actions. So I think the first job I'll have, if he does indeed become prime minister, is to push very hard that, you know, he takes personal responsibility, and that as prime minister we meet with him and he makes it clear that he wants to solve this case. To be fair, if his competitor Jeremy Hunt becomes prime minister, we'll do the same thing and make it clear that this needs to be top priority for the new government.
Richard Ratcliffe, whose wife Nazanin Zaghari Ratcliffe has been detained in Iran since 2016. Thanks for sharing a few minutes with us.
Thank you.
Heat waves are predictable and cities should be prepared to help people deal with them. That's the underlying message of new guidance from the International Federation of Red Cross and Red Crescent Societies. In a summer when Europe is battling record-breaking heat and a heat wave is overtaking much of the U.S. this week, that idea is reassuring, somewhat. But organizing cities to manage extreme heat, that does take some effort. Julie Arigi is a climate expert with the International Red Cross Red Crescent. She's one of the lead authors of the report. You're not just talking about setting up cooling centers when the temperatures go up. Your guide has some much bigger advice on how to build and arrange the whole infrastructure. Give us a few examples of the things you're recommending.
So our guide essentially looks at different phases of heat risk. We have recommendations that of things that can take place before a heat wave occurs, during a heat wave, after a heat wave, and also the longer-term urban planning approaches that need to be incorporated into cities to really capture those longer-term risk reduction strategies.
So give us a concrete example of the kind of infrastructure a city might retrofit to deal with, you know, increasing heat.
Right. So one, for example, are reflective roofs. Something as simple as just painting clusters, large clusters of roofs white. This helps to reflect the sun back out of the city. It helps to prevent buildings from heating up at higher levels. Urban greening is another one, especially in places that are growing, making sure that you grow with green spaces in mind because they also bring down the temperature of the city. But even in places that are already built.
You know the pattern, though. We get these like triple-digit temperatures that grabs people's attention. There's danger. And then the temperature goes down and panic subsides. What countries are getting this right and like really planning ahead?
Well, in the case in this guide that we've developed, we have a couple of case studies that highlight interesting examples from the U.S. So New York City is definitely leading the way in a variety of aspects on this. They have their Cool Cities Initiative, which is a really great example of the longer-term ways to retrofit strategies into existing city infrastructure. The city of Phoenix has also been doing quite a bit, and they're also featured in this guide. And abroad, we see a lot of this work, such as heat action plans, in Europe. This is largely because of a very extreme heat wave that occurred in 2003 that caused 70,000 excess deaths, which is really a massive amount of loss of life. But it's a silent disaster. You don't see it. It doesn't have that sort of startling image of places being flooded or, you know, the startling images that go along with earthquakes.
What climate change research informed how you developed this guidance?
The thing with heat is that it's one of the most confident projections we have about the future. So this is well documented in the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change reports. The other studies is one which shows that roughly 5 billion people in the world live in areas where the ability to forecast heat days or weeks in advance is possible. There's another study that was done by the University of Hawaii as well, which shows some of the projections into the future of regions of the world that are likely to be most at risk to be impacted by heat. Which really shows significant risk across areas that historically haven't had this heat wave issue.
So, I mean, your organization, the Red Cross, Julie, it's in the business of reacting to catastrophes and helping people prepare for them and deal with them when they happen. Are heat waves now reaching the same kind of risk level as hurricanes or other disasters?
Heat waves are amongst the deadliest disasters that we're facing today. This is an area of high importance for the Red Cross Red Crescent system to help ensure that we reduce the risks of heat waves.
Julie Arigi is a climate expert with the International Federation of the Red Cross and Red Crescent Societies and one of the lead authors of the just released Heat Wave Guide for Cities report from the IFRC. Julie, thanks for your time.
Thank you so much.
This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. It's The World. There are all sorts of lively debates in this country over how kids are taught in school. Same in Brazil, except there, the latest debate is more political than usual. Teachers have become a target for the country's new president, Jair Bolsonaro, and critics worry that he's using the nation's schools to gain support for the military. The World's Rupa Shenoy reports.
At 7 in the morning every weekday, this is where 10-year-old Victor Silva has to be, inside a building surrounded by a fence and guards with guns. Formation. Formation, Victor explains. This is when everyone lines up before they go to class. A police officer stands in front of them, issuing orders. Victor says he wants to be a naval officer when he grows up. And I ask him if that's because he's seen officers here at school. Victor looks slyly at his mother, Maria Paulina da Silva, who's taken a break from her job as a hairdresser to talk to me. Victor says he wants to work on a ship because he'll be away from his mother for months at a time. Maria Paulina grimaces and says her son and his friends needed the discipline the school offers and the safety it provides. She says she's had good experiences with the police here, and the whole neighborhood feels safe now. So she says it doesn't bother her that school police officers carry guns. And violence is a big issue in Brazil. 4 months ago, two young men armed with guns, crossbows, and axes killed seven people at a school they used to attend in a Sao Paulo suburb. They were inspired by the 1999 Columbine shooters in Colorado. That incident, and many others that didn't make the news, have made many more Brazilian parents accepting of armed officers in public schools.
Of course, it's different from a teacher carrying a gun, because usually a teacher doesn't have a training to do so. So if it's an officer and he carries a gun, it's okay because he's trained to do so.
David Nogueira is with the state agency that runs this public school and a few others like it.
The schools are in areas that are very violent. This is one of the things that the school were choosing, because they are situated in violent areas.
He says local school officials talked with police representatives for 2 years before they invited officers on campus. They arrived this January, the same month Jair Bolsonaro took office as president.
O propósito de transformar o nosso Brasil em uma grande, livre e próspera nação.
Bolsonaro championed these pilot schools and said he wants to replicate them across Brazil. And so the schools have become a symbol of his education policy. When they're discussed that way, they're often called military schools.
We don't call it military schools, and there's a difference, actually.
The difference is that these kids aren't being prepared to join the military. Nogueira insists that officers have no control over the curriculum. Still, a lot of Brazilians are skeptical.
Well, sometimes people get scary when you say that we have a partnership with the police. I think that in order to understand that, you have to understand the history of Brazil.
Just 35 years ago, Brazil was a military dictatorship. During that time, thousands of dissidents were tortured and hundreds were killed. Bolsonaro was in the armed forces during the dictatorship and ever since has defended that regime. He's suggested revamping school history books to portray the dictatorship in a more positive light. That's what worries Bolsonaro's critics, that he's trying to glorify the military over democratic values. Pablo Hortelado is a professor of public policy at the University of Sao Paulo.
There was a consensus in Brazilian society. All democratic forces understood that the military dictatorship was based on torture and disrespect for human rights, and it should be condemned. And now there is a wave of revising that.
Hortelado says Bolsonaro's trying to fundamentally shift public attitudes, in part by silencing teachers. Just before his inauguration, Bolsonaro tweeted that one of his goals was to, quote, combat the Marxist rubbish that is spread in educational institutions, unquote. He's backing a movement of conservative parents who complain that educators are teaching too many revolutionary ideas.
This is basically a conspiracy theory. There is not a survey with teachers saying that they are left wings. This is just an assumption, which is based on nothing as far as I can see.
The conservative parents movement encouraged students to videotape their teachers saying left-wing things. That created a tension in classrooms that was satirized by a popular TV show.
Hoje vamos falar sobre a suposta escravidão.
Students film a teacher while grilling her on subjects like slavery, the 1964 coup, and the Holocaust. Each time the nervous teacher refuses to give an opinion and says people could interpret these events in many ways. In real life, teachers have gotten fired. This is Pablo Hortelado again.
We already have like a feeling of censorship in the classroom, everywhere.
Hortelado says Bolsonaro and his allies are having an impact.
It's affecting the teaching of some things that they consider Marxism, like defending human rights, defending the rights of women and minorities. So there is already a lot of battle in the classroom around those issues, and they're going to be harder and harder, like in the U.S.
In Brazil, Bolsonaro tried to dramatically cut the federal education budget.
Tens of thousands of students and teachers took to the streets across Brazil for a one-day strike to protest a 30% cut in funding for public schools.
Teachers were crucial in the creation of a new public school system after Brazil became a democracy in 1988. They championed education as the most important tool many Brazilians of color have to advance in society. Claudio Antunes is a spokesman for a teachers' union in Brasilia.
Ela ataca a educação. Ela linkou a educação.
This attack on education is especially significant in a country with so many people who don't have a basic education, so many who are illiterate, so many who do not finish high school.
And as for the quasi-military schools, Antunes says they don't embrace inclusion and individual self-expression. And parents and students are being forced to trade those things for safety.
Democracy today is being questioned all the time, and we do not know what's going to prevail, the type of democracy we built after the coup, or what we have now, this environment of fear and of suppression of cultural inclusivity.
But back at the school in Brasilia, police officer Roberto Lobato Marx says he's most concerned with the immediate, desperate need of the children in his care.
You know, some of the kids can't even wash their school uniforms at night because they don't have enough water at home.
Marx says this is the first time in his 17 years as an officer that he's felt like he's made a difference in children's lives.
You can transform society if you have the means of reforming it from the inside of an institution.
Now, Mark says, students here have an oasis where they can live a normal life, learn what's right and wrong, and how to be good citizens. For The World, Rupa Shenoy, Brasilia, Brazil.
Tomorrow, Rupa has the final chapter in our Brazil series looking at the legacy of slavery there and how that affects politics today. Mexican drug lord Joaquin El Chapo Guzman was sentenced to life in an American prison today, plus 30 years.
His statement there in front of Judge Kogan was probably the last time that he'll be seen in public before he dies.
El Chapo may now be out of circulation, but the victims of drug cartel violence in Mexico still suffer. That's ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, WGBH, PRI, and PRX. Today, in a Brooklyn courtroom, a federal judge sentenced Joaquin Guzman to life in prison, plus 30 years. You know him better as El Chapo, the former head of the Mexican Sinaloa drug cartel. El Chapo was found guilty of drug trafficking and money laundering, not to mention multiple murder conspiracies. Now he's off to a supermax prison, likely in Colorado. U.S. officials say the Sinaloa cartel was once the largest trafficker of cocaine, heroin, and marijuana into the American market. Deborah Bonello has reported extensively on cartel violence across Latin America from her base in Mexico City. She says the Sinaloa cartel remains a major player even without El Chapo.
In a way, I think as long as he had been in prison in Mexico, he was always able to exercise his power from behind bars. And of course, a lot of the time that he was in Mexico, he spent on the lam and still managed to be one of the determining factors within the Sinaloa cartel. His extradition was a sign to the organized crime landscape in Mexico that he wasn't coming back. And that changed everything. So what you saw was this kind of internal struggle for power. So you had Ismael El Mayo Zambada, who is pretty much the last remaining old school capo now in Mexico and is the co-founder of the Sinaloa cartel along with Chapo. He continues to sit on the throne, but he's overseeing these different factions, one of which is managed by two of El Chapo's sons, the other by his brother. But despite those power struggles, the Sinaloa cartel carries on regardless, you know.
Yeah, so how has that struggle for power among the cartels redrawn the cartel map of Mexico? Like, where are the main cartels located now and who holds the power?
So we have the Sinaloa cartel still dominates the northwest of the country. States like Chihuahua, Sonora, Sinaloa, of course, are still controlled largely by them. And then when you come sort of further south, that's where you have the other major criminal organizations still wielding significant power in Mexico, which is the Jalisco New Generation cartel. And that cartel has gained power tremendously in the last decade, and any weakness or faltering that we've seen on the Sinaloa side has been to their advantage. But you also have a lot of other smaller criminal cells and organizations to the east towards the border in Tamaulipas. You have the Gulf cartel still operating, and there are plenty of diverse criminal cells that work and align themselves with these criminal organizations to provide whatever services it is that they need.
It sounds like El Chapo's extradition to the U.S. didn't really have any chilling effect on the cartels.
No, I mean, if you look at Mexico's homicide levels now, they are higher than they've ever been since records began. And a lot of that is to do with, yes, this rivalry between Jalisco New Generation and the Sinaloa cartel, but also the following of the kingpin strategy by the Mexican government, funded by the United States government, which takes out capos and kingpins. And what that does is create power vacuums, which generate more violence as other ambitious capos try to take their place.
You published essentially an opinion piece before his sentencing today, and you wrote, "I suggest U.S. authorities give El Chapo a slap on the wrist and think about letting him out for good behavior." Explain your reasoning, because based on everything we know about this man, most people are going to find your idea incomprehensible.
That column was slightly tongue-in-cheek, but the point that I'm making is that Chapo comes from an old generation of drug traffickers. I think it's really important to point out the image that he has in the American media and around the world as sitting on top of the throne of Mexico's international drug trafficking trade is inaccurate. You know, the Sinaloa cartel has historically had a horizontal hierarchy, largely based on the fact that a lot of the chiefs could be taken out at any time and compromise the running of the cartel. And I think organized crime saw a fundamental shift with the arrival of other criminal organizations after 2000, namely Las Zetas, who really upped the ante in terms of the use of violence as a form of terror and control. And they also detonated what was effectively an arms race amongst organized crime in Mexico. You know, they were using the kind of weapons that you hadn't seen before. They were throwing decapitated heads onto the floors of discos. They attacked the civilian population, again, in a way that you really hadn't seen before. So other criminal organizations, including that of the Sinaloa cartel, had no choice but to match that kind of weaponry and the use of that kind of violence to stay in the game. Now that you see El Chapo out of the game, you know, and the last sort of old school capo, El Mayo, still overseeing the Sinaloa cartel, but as far as I'm aware, not in great health, you have to ask yourself, left in the hands of these new, more millennial narcos, such as El Chapo's sons and El Mencho with the Jalisco New Generation, you have to wonder, where is that level of violence going to go? Because we're already seeing Mexican homicides at an all-time high. They have not gone down significantly since the middle of Enrique Peña Nieto's administration before AMLO. And that is not a good sign for where things are going in terms of security in Mexico and organized crime.
Deb Bonello has reported extensively on cartel violence in Mexico and Latin America. She's been speaking with us from Mexico City. Deborah, thanks very much.
Thank you, Marco. Good talking to you.
El Chapo's trial and sentencing have not ended the brutality of Mexico's drug cartels. Often those who get in the way end up disappeared and killed. Mirna Nareda Medina lost her son to cartel violence a few years ago. She's also the founder of a group in her home state of Sinaloa dedicated to helping families recover the remains of missing loved ones. They call themselves Las Rastreadoras. It's a little difficult to translate, but the name implies literally raking the ground for evidence of human remains. And that is exactly what they do. Mirna shared her story with the world's Maria Elena Romero.
Roberto Corrales Medina era un joven con muchos sueños.
My son, Roberto Corrales Medina, was a young man with many dreams. He had a great desire to live. But one day, on July 14, 2014, a van came and took him away. I went to the authorities and I asked them to look for him, but I didn't get any answers. So when I left the police station, I promised Roberto that I was going to look for him until I found him. I started to search on my own, but little by little, other men and women joined me. They were supporting me, but they were also looking for their own relatives. We found Roberto 3 years after he went missing. When I saw the grave, I knew it was him. I cried, I laughed, I did a lot of things because I didn't know what to do. I also felt relieved because I finally found an answer. As mothers, deep inside us, we know our children are dead, but we still hope that they are out there, alive. There is a lot of uncertainty, not knowing if he's alive or if he's dead. Is he cold? Is he crying? Is he in pain?
Since Mirna found Roberto's remains 2 years ago, her group has located the bodies of more than 100 more victims, and they've posted a video of how they do their work to their Facebook page. You can see a group of women standing around an unmarked grave. They're in the desert, and it's really bright. The sun is beating down on them. Mirna stands in the middle, and she's shoveling, and she starts chanting, "Why are we looking for them?" The rest of the group answers, "Because we love them." The group uses really simple tools to find the bodies, such as shovels and pickaxes, but also this metal bar that they stick into the ground. They then pull it out and sniff it to see if they can smell any trace of decomposing remains. It is gruesome work, which Mirna says they do every week on Wednesdays and Sundays.
On search day, we meet at the office. We have coffee, and at 8:30 in the morning, we put the tools in the car and say a prayer. We have photographs of all the boys we are looking for and all the boys we have found. We ask those we have found to help us, to show us the way so we can find what we are looking for. And to those who are still missing, we ask them for a sign, to talk to us, to tell us where they are. Sometimes we find a body, sometimes we don't. But the feeling of well-being, that stays with you after you have gone out to search. And whether you find someone or not, that gives us comfort and strength. We as mothers of the disappeared ask those who have a missing family member to never give up. And also to have faith that one day we are going to find them. That is the promise that I have made, to search and find everyone who is missing.
Mirna Nereda Medina leads a group called Las Rastreadoras in Sinaloa, Mexico. They're dedicated to helping families find the bodies of loved ones killed by drug cartel violence. Mirna shared her story with the world's Maria Elena Romero. This was the first track I ever heard by Johnny Clegg. Johnny Clegg, South African music legend, the White Zulu, who defied apartheid as a kid to hang with blacks who taught him to sing and dance and play the guitar. Johnny Clegg died yesterday at the age of 66, finally succumbed to cancer that he'd been public about for 4 years. Clegg was born in England, moved with his Zimbabwean mother to South Africa as a boy, and when Clegg was in his early teens, his stepfather, a black South African crime reporter, took him along on assignments to the townships, which is where he first heard sounds like these and the dances that went with them. Zulu music defined Johnny Clegg's 50-year career. In 2017, he came to the U.S. one last time to perform, and he told me about his remarkable dance and music education. As a teenager, he learned from Zulu laborers that he met in a segregated hostel. Here's an excerpt from that conversation.
It is only for men, no women, no other race groups allowed in. It's run by the municipal police. It's 2,000 men in a hostel. You know, I lived in that thing, you know, as a young 15-year-old, 16-year-old.
That's what's always kind of amazed me in apartheid South Africa, how you were accepted into this world.
Yeah.
It's baffling. Well, do you find it baffling still?
My passport was that I was a kid. And I was not yet, in a way, part of the oppressive apparatus. I wasn't an adult. I wasn't, you know, I wasn't going into the army. I was 15. And I had a genuine love and a genuine hunger for this. And they recognized that.
The dancers and singers accepted him. He'd sleep in the hostel, and after the men returned from their jobs, rehearsals with Johnny would start.
We were all bare-chested. We had Zulu car ties, dancing sandals, and black pants. And we'd sit there, and there was the absolutely overpowering, overwhelming smell of male sweat, some of it from a few days ago, and mixed in with the most amazing male vocal singing. It would be reverberating around you and bouncing off the walls. And it was so, it was just overwhelming. And so the smell and the sound together made such a strong statement for me. You know, when I was in the middle of that, I felt invincible.
Not so much, though, when the police raided the hostel one day and wanted to know who this white kid was with all these tough black South African dancers.
And they said to me, "Are you all right?" And I said, "Yeah, I'm fine." And they said, "What are you doing?" I said, I'm dancing." And they said, "It's okay, you don't have to say that." I said, no, I'm learning how to dance." And then they got upset. And they took me out and they put me in the car and they took me to my mom. And they said, "Look, you know, we found your boy there. We only go in there with guns. We have dead bodies coming out there every weekend. These are very violent and fractious people."
What'd your mom say?
She was shocked.
But the leader of the dancers spoke to Clegg's mom and convinced her that Johnny was a talent and they'd take care of him.
She felt comforted by that. And then she just said, "Look, you know, look after yourself." And I must say, my mom was an amazing person. My mom wanted to be Ella Fitzgerald. So when I said, "I want to be a Zulu guitarist," she got it. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And she said, "Well, at least you're lucky because you can get to do it, you know."
Johnny Clegg speaking there in 2017 on his farewell tour of America. He was lucky, and so are we, that he was able to do what he did. Here's a big hit of Johnny Clegg's that pretty much captures his view of life. It's called "Cruel, Crazy, Beautiful World." An agreement got inked in Sudan today. The mediator was seen tearing up after leaders from the opposing side signed the deal.
"It is a great moment that the people of the Sudan have reached this historic moment."
The agreement follows months of demonstrations that turned violent. Investigating the military's role in that violence is part of the peace deal. The two sides, military leaders and civilians, also agreed to rotate power. First up, the military will lead the new governing council for 2 years. After that, the civilian leadership takes over. Ahmed Gandour is an engineer and activist in Khartoum, and he's still absorbing the news.
"I ended up in a cafe where there was a TV, and we were waiting for this to unfold. But last night, actually, we took to the streets to sound our voice that we do not want the party that's representing us, which is the FFC, to let go of any of their demands or lower their ceiling, because we are reminding them that they represent the voice of the people."
What is the mood today where you are in Sudan? What is it like?
Well, actually, it's a muted celebratory mood, basically because people still have suspicions around the military council that's ruling the country at the moment, thinking that there might be some detours that they're planning for this. But generally, people are celebrating the fact that the two parties have reached an agreement.
Mm. But are the suspicions? I mean, what are those detours that people are worried about that you referred to?
What I was referring to is that if the military commanders overseeing the country now have any plans to seize the authority or overthrow the agreement, then they have the means and the power.
What you're saying is that the civilians are worried that the party they're negotiating with have guns and they don't, correct?
That's true. And there's also fears that there might be, I would say, some entities related to the previous regime that are still within the military spectrum that might not be in agreement with what has been signed, and they might be looking for a military coup or something to try and retake powers of the country.
So concerns among civilians that there might be some dissent in the military. What is your personal reaction to this agreement?
Well, actually, Marco, I'm looking at this as it is something to be celebrated, because this is the culmination of an effort that has been ongoing for the past 3 months or so. And we actually understand that what has been signed is a pretext to what should come next Friday, as has been promised, which is the constitutional declaration. In that document, we believe that the specifics and details of this agreement that was signed earlier today are going to be revealed and discussed furthermore between the two parties.
Ahmed Gondour, thanks for sharing your thoughts on this news of an agreement between civilians and the military in Sudan. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Finally today, when you mention you're traveling to Argentina, somebody is bound to bring up tango. The dance is embedded in Argentine culture, and tango is steeped in traditional male and female roles. But some women in Argentina are pushing back against machismo on the dance floor. The World's Alison Herrera has our story from Buenos Aires.
On a Friday evening, couples at the Cheek to Cheek studio swirl around the dance floor. They're dancing tango, of course. Cheek to Cheek hosts what's known here as a milonga, a kind of informal tango club where people can practice and learn new steps.
Hola, Viviana. How are you? I'm glad you came earlier.
Viviana Parra is a longtime teacher in the Buenos Aires tango scene. She tells me the first time she tried tango, she wasn't that into it.
Well, I thought tango was for older people, and I thought it was artificial, the way they dress, the way they express, and I didn't like it.
But her friends persuaded her to take a lesson so she could be part of a showcase in Miami. She wanted the free ticket to the U.S., so she did it.
I took one lesson, and I never stopped dancing, and I never went to Miami. And I stopped, I quit university, I quit my job, everything, because once you get into the tango, you go like addicted. And I really never stopped.
It's been 25 years since that first lesson, and a lot has changed. More younger people dance tango now. The way people dress when they're on the dance floor has changed as well. More women are wearing jeans instead of fishnets and high heels. And now it's not just men. Women can lead too.
Because the tango is macho. Was macho. Not anymore. There's a new song that says, "Atendi, muchachos, el tango ya no es macho."
That song, in English it says, "Hey guys, tango isn't macho anymore." Aside from the fact that Parra was chided earlier in the evening by a male organizer for wearing hiking boots and not high heels, the dance floor has become a more inclusive place for women. And that has something to do with more women in Buenos Aires speaking up about their rights.
Here it's happened in the last 2 years, 3 years. Women are in the street saying what we don't want anymore, and we are at the milongas also saying that we don't want anymore.
What she and other female dancers don't want anymore, she says, is to be treated like objects. That's why she joined a Facebook group called Movimiento Feminista del Tango, or the Tango Feminist Movement. The group promotes LGBTQ tango spaces and milongas that aren't, in their words, machista. They also call out male teachers who act inappropriately with their female students.
The truth is that we have a problem with men in tango, because women will come and complain about, oh, when he was teaching the class, he did this to me, or he forced me to do that, and I didn't want to.
Parra says female tango dancers have taken a page from Argentine actresses who started to speak out about harassment in their profession. She says at first it was hard for women in tango to talk about what was going on. But now they are talking, and she says male teachers are paying attention.
Some of them understand that this is the beginning of the change, and it's good that we're talking loud, we're speaking out to the problems in the tango community, like in any other community.
Para says that to dance tango is to be very aware of your partner, to respect their space and their body. It just makes sense, she says, for that respect to be part of the way that everyone interacts on the dance floor. For The World, Alison Herrera, Buenos Aires.
Alison's reporting in Argentina was supported by the International Women's Media Foundation. That's all for us today. The World's theme music was composed by Ned Porter. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. We'll see you back here tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.